listening to the Uber Dad Podcast
with your host, Rick Brown.
Welcome to Uber Dad. This is episode number 4. Have you ever asked your kids what they want to be when they grow up? Has anybody else got an answer other than professional video gamer or YouTuber? It got me thinking back to when I was a kid, and my dad used to ask me all the time, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" Of course, to me, it sounded like this.
Who are you? Where do you come from? Are you listening to me? What do you want to do with your life?
Of course, it wasn't actually like that. My dad was very good about it, and he didn't yell. But that's what it felt like to me, because I had no idea what that even meant or what the options were. When I was a teenager, I was convinced I was going to be a rock star. I seriously was. And, there was no internet back then. My parents worked from home, so I really, had no frame of reference for what the options might be. These days, the world has completely changed, and there are jobs that never existed before. Being a YouTuber is actually a thing. Playing video games and making money at it is also possible. There are people out there that make a living just writing blogs about stuff they really love. I mention things like that to my boys, but it doesn't seem to register. I think they're very much in the same situation I was 800 years ago, and they don't really know what the career options are out there. I think the sooner that somebody finds their passion, the faster they can actually start learning about it. And, these days, you don't even really need to wait to get a job before you can actually try it out. You want to be on TV? Start your own YouTube channel. Start acting. Start reporting. It's all possible. I don't think it really was so much back in the day. I thought it would be interesting to start talking to people that have cool, different, or fun jobs so that you can start this conversation with your own kids. To start it off, we have a very dear friend of mine, Peter Whitehead. Peter is the creative director for the Walt Disney Hometown Museum in a cool little town called Marceline. Peter is the biggest Disney fan I have ever met, and there could not be a more perfect job for him. It combines all of his creative skills with his lifelong passion. He was born to do this job. That interview is coming up shortly. In talking to Peter, it made me think about how I originally met him. And when I finally realized that I wasn't going to make it as a rock star, and I was really close, but, just didn't happen that last little bit. And I started to actually think about what I wanted to do for a living. I realized that I loved advertising. And my dad was a designer, so he had literally hundreds, if not thousands, of design books in the house. And I used to sit there and look through them. They were glossy award annuals, just showcasing the very best work in advertising from around the world, which was hard to, see it kind of anywhere else back then. And what I didn't realize was that I was absorbing and accidentally studying brilliant creative work. And I went to college for business and marketing, not creative and design, which is exactly why we need to help our kids start thinking about their career paths. I went down the wrong road, wildly down the wrong road. Once I realized I wanted to be in advertising, I found this small ad agency in my hometown. They had a cool logo on the side of this beautiful building that used to be an old mill. It was spectacular, exposed brick, wooden beams, in a very modern interior. This is where I wanted to work. So I went in, and I asked to speak to the owner. This was the first time I actually showed any initiative when it came to my career, other than music. And I spoke to the general manager. We sat down, and he was very nice, and we had a great chat. Until it got to the part where he asked me, "What do you think is an entry-level job in advertising?" And at that point, I struggled to reach deep back into my memory banks of my college days and remember that one of my teachers said that a starting career in advertising was in media. So I said, "Media." I didn't even know what media was. And I also didn't realize that I happened to be talking to the world's biggest media freak. And he lost it on me. "Are you kidding me? Media is a specialized field and okay, whatever, lunch boy." You know what? This guy's just constantly out to lunch with, he's out to lunch, but he was also out to lunch constantly with media people. And I didn't realize he was a freak. Anyway, so I completely thought I was done. I was about to get up and leave. And he's like, "Oh, you know what? I think we can find a job for you here." And so he hires me, and this begins my trek down another wrong path. And so I start wearing these terrible suits. Oh, my God. These suits that were like 3 inches from the top of my shoe, and these shoes that looked like they were made out of dolphin skin. Don't ask. Anyway, so here we are, and we're going to meet with clients. And he's this short guy, and he's driving this massive Cadillac, and he's peering between the steering wheel and the dashboard. And we're going to see some clients. And it was a pharmaceutical agency, and he used to be a pharmacist. He had no experience in advertising, so this was going to be great. And we would go and talk to these guys, and he would have great chats, you know, because it was the pharma club. And the client would brief us and give us these, you know, printouts and give us a very solid brief on what he wanted. So we would leave there and we would get back into his, you know, giant automobile. And I would have to listen to him rant about how the client didn't know what he was talking about. And he's completely wrong. And he's like, you know what? Take this down. And he would start giving me an alternate brief. And when we got back to the agency, we gave them his info, the alternate brief. We told them it came from the client, but it actually came from this weasel. They would look at us as if we were really on something, and he might have been, but I was just wearing bad suits. And they would go away, you know, again, you're not fully convinced that we were giving them all the right information. And in those days, things took longer than they do now, so it might have been a week or so later that we would, you know, gather up all the artboards and we would go in. Now, proper presentation, I learned far later down the road, the creative people come in, the creative director does the presentation. Not here. So Weasel Boy and I go back, and we've got these artboards all mounted on black foam core with 3 inches border all around, because everything looks good with a 3-inch black border. And we would sit in the client's office, and he would just flip the boards over one by one, like he's Vanna White. There was no proper introduction or anything. He's just flipping the cards over, hoping that the client would look at it, see it, and go, oh my God, that's brilliant, which they never did. And pretty much every time we were picked up by the pants, cartoon style, and hurled out the door towards the car. And then we'd get back and we'd dust off and we'd get back in the car and we'd drive back, and then I'd have to listen to him rant about the creative people and how they really screwed up this time. And we'd get back to the agency, and he would literally scream at the creative people. And I remember starting to realize, wow, this doesn't seem right, you know. But I was in no position to say anything. And again, I was new at this. After all that, I realized that I actually loved hanging out with the creative people and talking to them and watching the artwork be created. Like, that was the thing that really inspired me. And one day, a miracle happened, and a box was brought into the agency and plunked down on a desk, and it was a Macintosh computer. It was 1986, and it was a Macintosh SE. That moment changed my life, because I couldn't get enough of that thing, and nobody else in the agency, none of the designers were even remotely interested in it. I couldn't get enough of it, so I played with this computer day and night, and I learned how to do all kinds of things on it. And they suddenly realized, oh my God, you can actually take our pencil sketches here and put this on the computer. And I did. And then that actually became quite useful. That was the moment that changed my life. Had that not happened, I don't even know what I'd be doing right now. Now, even though I was getting very good at working on the computer and I was learning design the hard way, there was still this little issue of us getting bad information from the suits. That's what they call the account executives that manage the client relationships and bring in the work. Our work was terrible. It was embarrassing. Out of the blue one day, a real advertising agency, a cool downtown Toronto ad agency with real clients, came in and bought us. And I remember thinking, do you even know what you're buying here? Because you're buying nothing. And I kept remember thinking how badly they were getting ripped off. When they took over, they brought in a new young creative director. It was Peter. He and I became friends instantly, although he has a slightly different take on it, as you'll hear later in the interview. I loved the way he thought. No limitations. He just thought so big. And it was amazing to see. And I was coming from a place where it was all limitations. So, you know, it changed our work immediately. And everything got really, really cool. And I really have to thank Peter for that, because it changed my life. And it's put me on the right path. And ultimately, that's got me to where I am today.
Hey, Peter, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ricky, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Not bad.
So this is a series I'm doing on cool, different careers, and you're our first guest. Can you tell us a bit about what you do for a living?
I am the creative director at the Walt Disney Hometown Museum in Marceline. So as the creative director, I get to do a ton of stuff. I get to go in and essentially tell stories within the museum in three dimensions. So we have overhauled the museum in the last little bit and taken gallery spaces out and replaced them with something that I thought might attract more guests to our museum. So they're more interactive. They shine a spotlight on a different aspect of a story that we might have already told in Marceline in the past. But I've been given the keys to the candy store, essentially. I get to come in and get to do just about anything that I want, from filming video to doing commercials to doing a speaker series here with Disney legends who get to come to Marceline and tell their story. It is an unbelievable job for someone who has a real passion for Disney. It's crazy that I'm here.
When you were a kid growing up, do you think you could have ever imagined that you'd be in this job?
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. It's strange the way I got here. And it is truly to me one of those, if you do have a passion in life, and people, I think it's a silly thing to say and mean when you say, you know, if you have a passion, pursue it because you won't, you know, work a day in your life. Well, that's, I guess we can't swear on this, but it's
sure
silly.
Oh,
can you? It's bullshit. It's you, even if you find the job that you're passionate about, if anything, you work exponentially harder so that dream doesn't ever go away. So for me, finding this job is being amazing. I mean, it's a crazy journey, and it happened in a really weird time in my life, as you're aware, because I lost one of my sons. So it was one of those things where you sit back and you think, well, what am I doing? and even if I had picked this as a job, I don't know how I would have found it or how I would have made it happen. It sort of fell into my lap, which is fantastic and strange all at the same time. But being a creative director is not something that I'm foreign to. I mean, you and I worked together in the wonderful world of advertising for a long, long time. And I thought that that was me, much like you just said, when you talked to your father and your father said, what do you want to do when you grow up? Well, my dad was a studio guy forever. And that's all I ever thought I wanted to do. I just wanted to be like my dad. And storytelling, I mean, being a creative director in many ways is all about storytelling, even if you're telling it in incredibly short 30-second increments. It led me to a job directing commercial work, which led me to a job shooting documentaries, which led me to this job telling stories, each leg of that road, but in very different ways. So.
Can you tell us what kinds of things you actually do day to day in your job?
Sure. So I work in Marceline, Missouri. For Disney fans, Marceline will spark a certain degree of interest because it's where Walt Disney grew up. It is by far the one place on the face of the earth where he drew inspiration for all sorts of things, theme parks, for television shows, for movies that he produced. He grew up in his most formative years here in Marceline, Missouri. And so there is a museum dedicated to the Disney story, Walt and Roy more specifically, because they are the people that are identifiable as Disney family members. But there is a museum here that was started thanks to an incredibly generous gift by Walt's sister, Ruth. When she passed away, she had amassed a pretty impressive collection on her two older brothers, and she only wanted it showcased in one place, in Marceline. So our current executive director was the recipient of that gift. And what do you do when you get 3,000 artifacts handed to you? You have a cool basement, or you start a museum. And so The museum was started in Marceline, and it had run for almost 15 years before I got involved, and hadn't essentially changed over that 15 years. It was set up. It's a nonprofit. It's incredibly hard to get to Marceline. We're in the middle of Missouri. So if you took a straight line between Kansas City and St. Louis, we're almost in the middle, maybe shy, half an hour closer to Kansas City, but we're not easy to get to for sure. But this is where the story is. So this is where the museum is. And I showed up with my son, Christopher. I mean, we just grew up as a Disney family, being very into Disney. When he was finished university, he was living in Vancouver at the time, and decided that before he was going to start a career, he was going to have some fun. So he applied for a job at Disney and got it. So he was a cultural ambassador at Epcot. So he worked in the Canadian Pavilion at Le Cellier restaurant for a year. And when I drove from Toronto to pick him up and whipped across the country with him, we were within striking distance of Marceline. Didn't know there was a museum here. Just knew I wanted to visit Marceline. And he, as a future Disney employee, thought it was important to go visit Marceline, and stumbled into this museum and thought, wow, this is cool. And all I thought about is what I could do to help them. You talk about storytelling, they had some amazing things, but I just kept thinking, maybe if we shifted the spotlight to a slightly different set of stories, or we told our stories in a different way, we could do something special here. And so that was 3 years ago. And when I reached out to help them do a documentary film, I found out that they were in fact hiring, because the board of directors decided they needed to make a push to increase attendance and get our awareness levels up. And I was very late in the game, throwing my hat in the ring, and did not think it would happen, because I'd have to come from Canada. So there's an extra set of hurdles to get across. But lo and behold, I got offered this job in 2015. So I've been here for 3 years.
Didn't they create this job specifically for you, though?
Sort of. It was the position that I am currently in was not necessarily the position they were looking to hire. They were looking for a museum executive, like a museum person who would be able to go in and write grants and all that fun stuff. But I thought, you know, we needed more than grant writing ability. We needed to be able to be self-sustaining. We needed to pay our own bills without the generous gifts that we received from various foundations. And the only way to do that was to increase attendance and increase our social media reach, and reach out to Disney and figure out what our relationship was and how it could grow. And it's really blossomed over the last 3 years. We've doubled our attendance, and we are holding our gala next year and the year previous to that in Walt Disney World. So Disney is certainly appreciative of the work we're doing, and now starting a dialogue about how they can help us tell that in a more robust way. So all the things that we had hoped to accomplish, we have. And that's definitely one of those things where if you come in with a mind frame and a passion and have an end goal, you just forge forward and hope things fall into place, and they seem to have fallen into place.
I'm sure that's an understatement, but you know what? How cool is it for you to go in at to work every day and work on this?
Yeah.
You're the biggest Disney fan I've ever met.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that. I'm putting a presentation together because I'm going to talk down in Florida next month. So I've been invited to speak at both Disney World and Disneyland to cast members, which seems ludicrous to me because I still consider myself just a fan. I'm just a dude who goes to the park and loves Mickey Mouse and all that fun stuff. And for me to put on a different hat and have people stare at me and, you know, look at me as an authority on Disney seems silly, but it's super cool. And much to your point, I was pretty into Disney, maybe more than a man, a grown-up should be. And then you come to Marceline, and I'm nothing compared to the people who are just die-in-the-wool crazy Disney fans. They they come with a knowledge base.
And most of the people there have either met him or they have some Walt story.
They do, yeah, which is really strange. Even our executive director, she and her mother is still alive. She's Inez Johnson, who's one of the co-founders of our museum. They hosted the Disneys when they came back in 1956. They came back for a pool dedication. And they stayed in their house because they were the only house in Marceline with central air conditioning, which is kind of funny. But they stayed with them and they became friends for the last decade of Walt's life. Visited Disney, got tours through Disney with Walt Disney, stayed at Walt's Holmby Hills property. Our executive director, when Walt and Lee and Disney came in 56, they stayed in her bedroom. That was her claim to fame as a child. She got shipped off to the neighbors and Walt and Lillian took over her room for their visit. So it is really crazy as a Disney fan. I will speak as a Disney fan to be in Marceline. And it's like a Twilight Zone episode. I often say, if you take all the residents of Marceline, put them on Main Street and have them put their hand up, if they have Walt's autograph or met Walt Disney, almost every hand will go up. It's weird. And if they don't have the autograph, they'll tell you why they had to sell it, when they had to sell it. Like their dishwasher broke in 1976 and they had to sell it for this amount of money and they hate that they sold it because it would be worth more now. But they all have Disney stories. So yeah, as a Disney fan, to just be here and have a fresh perspective on it and try to harvest that fun back into Marceline, because there's a lot of people here that don't understand why someone who lived here for 5 years as a young boy, they don't understand the connection or the passion that Walt had for this city. So they're very willing to overlook it or give it up. So as a newbie, you have to come in and excite people again.
I saw a story on CNN just the other day about Marceline, and they were talking about how areas of that town have served as inspiration for so many sections within the Disney theme parks, like things like the Coca-Cola building and others. I've got to imagine that article is going to drive a lot of people to go and visit now that they realize it's there, right?
It is funny because in the last week, people have come to the museum. I don't know if we've cycled up per se, but we've had a lot more guests recently who will show up and go, did you know you were on CNN? I'm like, I did know we were on CNN. It took 6 months to get that story towards CNN. Like it's a hard slog. And that's a reporter coming to Marceline and hearing the story, experiencing the story and saying, I need to share this. This is too good to keep quiet. So that's the important thing. That's the really crazy important thing to do in Marceline right now is to be folksy, because we're small town Missouri, small town funsy, hey, let's all go and do a show in the barn kind of community. But in the same breath, there has to be a level of professionalism on how you tell your story to get people to appreciate that this is not a fluke, that this is a solid story that's been well thought out, and get them to help participate and spread the news.
Wait, so did you have something to do with getting that article on CNN?
Literally took about 6 months of asking for photos and more photos and interviews and chats and all that fun stuff. A super nice guy who was really passionate about helping us tell our story, and it went crazy. Both at CNN, apparently, it's being incredibly well received and got a lot of clicks on their website, but it's being picked up all over the place too. So you'll see ABC and Fox, and suddenly somebody will repost it and they'll have a different headline, which is a funny thing about news. They just try to find, like, you know, they try to get somebody to click on their site. So it's Disney's about to invest in revamping small Missouri town. I'm like, really? Cool, let me click on this and see what it is. And it's the same story, but it's just got some crazy headline to try to get people to participate with their website. But it's such a valuable story, and it's so important to tell. If you go work at Disney, like my son went to work at Disney, you take a course called Traditions when you start. And part of Traditions is about Marceline. It's about Walt's time here, Walt's inspiration, the times he came back. We are part of the corporate fabric of the Walt Disney Company. So it's not like a George Washington slept here moment. It is something that we have to take incredibly seriously and do exceptionally well, even though we are not funded as of yet by the Disney Company in any way, shape, or form. There is a sense that we are telling a Disney story, so we have to reach certain standards in how you interact and how the stuff in your museum store looks and all that fun stuff. I take that incredibly seriously.
And that ties in with, you know, how you are the biggest Disney fan I know. I mean, nobody would be more familiar with the Disney standards than you. Has Disney themselves started to take notice of what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. D23 is the Disney-funded fan club for the Disney Company. There was a thing called Disneyanna, which was started literally by fans. Disney was a passive participant in that and then started seeing the kind of the numbers that wanted to reach out and celebrate the Disney brand. So Disney started their own called D23. So in 1923 is the year that Walt left Kansas City after his Laugh-O-Gram studios here went bankrupt. And he went out to California and the Disney company will say 1923 is the year that he started to become the Disney that everyone knows now. He started to hit his stride and his success. So yeah, D23, 1923 is the year that they celebrate with their fan club. And they came out here 6 years ago and did an activity here, and it went over really well, but there was no reason to come back anytime soon because, again, we weren't really evolving as a museum. We weren't telling new stories or changing the interior of the museum. We weren't doing a lot of anything other than being a facilitator to tell the same story to the people that would come. So part of my job when I got here was to try to reconnect and tell Disney that we were changing, convince them to come out. And they finally came out this year, for instance. They sold 100 tickets to come out in less than a minute. It was the one place where Disney fans, I don't know how many events they do every year at D23. I'm guessing 75 or 100, maybe. I don't even know how many events they do. But this was apparently the one that Disney fans got excited about. And so we had 100 guests out about a month ago. And the Disney Company could not believe what had happened here. And the transformation of our storytelling ability and the way we interact with guests. And just, I think, people come to Walt Disney Museum and expect it to be kid-friendly because Disney is kid-oriented. And we were just as much a library as we were a museum. There's a lot to read. There's a lot of letters, a lot of correspondence. Very cool for adults, just deadly boring for kids. So we focus on telling kids stories and having interactive videos play now that you can hear a little bit of Walt's time as a boy here. And the Disney Company came in and were like, oh my God, this is crazy what's happening right now. So suddenly there's this talk about coming every 2 years all of a sudden to Marceline, which is the reason that it started to spark all that interest. So, you know, hard work pays off sometimes, which is nice.
It's amazing what you've achieved in just a few years. And I got to imagine that the people from Marceline are so glad that you showed up. Because other than that, they seemed like they were just kind of standing still.
I think so. I can't take all the credit for it. I think the thing I can take credit for is visualizing what it could be and being able to convince people to go along for the ride. The story was already here. It was just looking at it with fresh eyes. And I think literally you could have come in here and done somewhat the same thing because anyone with any kind of creative insight would look into this museum and have said, what if that was that? I mean, everyone would have done it a different way, but I took a specific approach.
You know what? I think you're selling yourself a little bit short there, my friend.
I'm short. I am short.
You're not short.
I'm short.
Listen, I know from working with you that you think big and you have no limits. And that was the, for me, that was the thing that turned my career around. I was working with people that thought in this tiny little, you can't do this, you can't do that kind of way. And they were happy with the status quo. And, you know, that just felt wrong to me, but I couldn't articulate it. And then you came in and completely changed the way we did everything. And just suddenly there was, you know, there was no limits. And I love that. And that was, and I could see you bringing that to Marceline because, you know, again, there is no bigger Disney fan, at least that I know. And with your passion, drive, and ability to think big like that, you can turn this place around and have this kind of incredible achievement. I'm excited to see what happens in the future.
I appreciate you saying that. When I knew I was going to be chatting with you, because we haven't chatted for a while, I started thinking about day one when we first started working together. And it's funny because my take when we first started working together is that I drove you crazy because you running the studio and me coming in as a art director, and I always had kind of a vision of what I wanted. And then I'd sit down with you and we'd start building something. And I'd always be like, that's super cool. But what if we did this instead? Cause I'm a visual guy. So I would look at stuff and go, oh, that could be cool if it got moved over here. And you just stare at me sometimes and be like, dude, just make up your mind. But
I apologize if I did that, but you know what? Honestly, I was impressed and blown away by the work that you did. And I loved working with you. So, you know, it was, if anything, it was probably just because the computers were so friggin' slow.
Totally.
You know, the loading bar would take forever.
Yeah, you go have a coffee. That's right.
Exactly. It would take about 2 hours. It's incredible how much faster computers are these days. See, I wouldn't look at you funny that way anymore.
It is amazing, isn't it? Like when I came here, part of what I could bring to this museum was a computer, which sounds really funny, but you'll appreciate that. So when you have Adobe Suites with you and I can sit down and I can build an ad or I can build a clip, I can cut together a video, it changed the complexion and the speed in which you did stuff at this museum. So all of a sudden, instead of having 14,000 different fonts in the museum, we picked a font and ran with it, which sounds simple, but it was important to start to figure out who we were and why we were picking that font, not even just arbitrarily picking it, but having a reason to pick it and creating a logo and just starting to brand yourself. It's the stability. It's that foundation that we needed to move forward. And that's maybe what a bean counter or a museum person who was just writing grants couldn't have brought to this project, I guess. So
exactly.
It's great. I mean, it's amazing. You know, it's part of the presentation that I'm about to make is sort of about the time that I started to think about coming here. And it was a difficult time because, again, growing up as a Disney family, we were at Disney when my youngest son passed away. And it's one of those things where you reflect back on it and you think, oh my God, like, can I even go to Disney anymore? Like, would I want to go to Disney and spend time anymore? And we just got pushed into a very Disney life, career. And so you just went there. And then, you know, Christopher went and worked at Disney for a while. And now I'm here running a Disney museum. It is pretty amazing. It's the last 3 or 4 years have, number one, flown by, but have been for me transformative. It's a different world to go to the park and to just know, again, this is such a geeky thing, but to know Disney legends, like to know animators that worked with Walt that I call my friend now and I can chat with and get together when I go to Florida or California is a Disney geek dream come true. So I've taken full advantage of it, this ride.
As you should. So I imagine you've got a million projects on the go, but what's the one that has you most excited?
Oh, man. So I'll tell you about a project that we're working on right now, which I find fascinating. And it's a thing called Midgetotopia. So Midgetotopia has a really crazy history with the Disney company. It was brought into Disneyland in 1956, so a year after the park opened. It wasn't created by the Disney company. It was a ride that was purchased, but it ran for 10 years. If you go to either of the Disney parks right now, you can still ride Autopia. But at the time in 56, there were four versions. There were two Autopias, one in Fantasyland and one in Tomorrowland, that merged to become the ride you would ride right now, a thing called Junior Autopia and a thing called Midget Autopia, which doesn't sound very politically correct, but it is what it was called. And Midget Autopia was just for kids. Adults couldn't ride in it. And Walt always had a problem with that ride because his philosophy was go to the park and have fun with your kids, not watch your kids have fun. And adults had to just sit there and watch as their kids pretended to drive around this little track, and it was adorable and fun. But when they brought some rides back from the World's Fair, it was time to take some of that excess baggage in the park out so that they had room to bring some of those rides in. So if you went to California and you went to It's a Small World, that ride, Midgetotopia, was removed when that ride came in for space. And instead of just dismantling it or throwing it away, they, through Walt's private company, Retlaw, brought it to Marceline. And it is a piece of history because it is the only ride to ever leave a Disney park but maintain operation without Disney's control. So it kept, but Disney had nothing to do with it. It was a gift from Walt to the city of Marceline. And it ran here for 11 years, so it actually ran here a year longer than it did in the park. But at that time, it was 21 years old, and it had been through a lot. Walt had passed away, had stopped funding it to run, and it died, sadly. It just went away. And just recently, there's been talks forever about bringing it back, but we've made some headway in trying to bring that piece of history back to Marceline for 40 some odd years. There was a concrete track in the Disney Municipal Park. Kids rode their bikes there, didn't know the history of what they were playing on. That actual track was removed last year because of safety concerns. And we're in the process right now of raising money to bring that ride back. And the Disney company is excited about it, which was a big deal to get them on board. And we are just starting to reach out to Disney fans to help support the return of that walking track, at least as a foundation for building the ride on at some point in the future. But as you and I, you know, talk about, technology changes constantly. So that ride might come in a different form. It might become a static ride within the museum where you put on goggles and go on a 3D ride of the original track in California. I mean, how cool would that be? So there's all sorts of discussions about what it would be, but to bring the physical track back and allow visitors to come and for free and go to the E.P. Ripley Park extension that we just built in Marceline and to walk that track is a big deal. That's one of those crazy projects that has taken a long, long time to get even Disney's permission to do that much. And it's, you know, that's the kind of thing where you meet people. Like when we were talking about meeting Disney legends, you go to California to drum up support, and suddenly you find yourself on the Disney studio, which I never thought I'd be, but I've been there a bunch of times now, and walking around, getting a tour from a Disney legend, like an animator, like Floyd Norman, who worked on The Jungle Book and all those really beautiful old Disney movies. Last time I was there, he took me on a studio tour to show me where his office used to be, and we grabbed lunch in the commissary, and it just blew me away.
Wow.
Yeah, it is funny. To go to the archives, sit down with Becky Klein, who's the head of the archives, and talk about how she can help us in Marceline, that's something that really didn't happen until the last few years. So I am living a super privileged life right now in Marceline.
Awesome. You have a GoFundMe page for that, don't you?
We do. So it's GoFundMe.com/Autopia, Autopia.
I'll put that in the show notes.
So it's one of those things where a lot of people have come on and given a large dollars, which is great. But the thing is that I would just as much rather, you know, reach 1,000 Disney fans who give $1 as a few that give a couple hundred. It's one of those things where you might not think it's going to change much if you give $5 to a campaign like that. But if we get enough people who really are truly passionate about Disney, and I would say in Canada has a great Disney connection because Walt's dad was born just outside of Goderich in Blueville. So maybe a lot of Canadians don't know that you know, the Disney family heritage and lineage runs right into Canada. So,
Peter, thank you so much for joining us and for being our first guest in the career series that we're doing here.
Oh, dude, thank you. I appreciate the phone call. I appreciate chatting with you. I haven't seen you for a long time.
Thank you to Peter for doing that interview. It was so awesome to talk to somebody that loves what they do and has finally found exactly what they were born to do. And I'm very happy for him. I hope it's inspired you. It's definitely inspired me. So today's show was a little bit of a different format. You may have noticed it didn't have any update, no crazy phone calls or anything like that. That's the great thing about podcasting is you can try different things, see what's working, what's not. And right now I'm just experimenting and trying to find the things that really work for you guys. If there's anything that you enjoyed in previous episodes that's missing here, then email me, host@uberdadshow.com. For those of you that are still with us on the show here and still awake, here's a little update on what I'm up to in just case you're interested or curious. Based on all the positive feedback I've been getting on the show and how it sounds and everything, it kind of gave me the confidence to do something I've always wanted to do. And I know you're thinking something really strange right now, but no. Voiceovers and voice acting. I've always wanted to do it. I got to try it a little bit when I was in advertising because, you know, we'd be in recording studios doing TV commercials, radio commercials, whatever, and every once in a while, they'd throw you in front of the mic, and next thing you know, your voice is on a commercial running across the country, and that did happen to me a couple of times. I got to do some commercials for The Keg, and I loved it. So, anyway, I was listening to a podcast recently, and they were talking about somebody that put themselves through school doing voiceovers, because there's a site now called voices.com, and you could sign up there and create a profile and put your demo on there and start auditioning. So I did it, and I've been doing it for a little while now, just maybe a month or so. I've actually been selected for a few jobs now, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it actually kind of is when you consider that there's more than 100 people auditioning for each of these jobs. And that was, I'd only maybe done maybe 20 auditions at that time, so it's a pretty good ratio. And anyway, I just love doing it. It's fun. And I kind of do it when I have little breaks. If I, you know, do my regular work and lunchtime or, you know, coffee break time, I will run upstairs and jump into a closet. That just sounds weird. That just really, okay. Anyway, and I'll do these voice auditions. And it's a lot of fun. And if you're curious, here's my voice demo.
Are you ready to get revved up? Valley View Automotive's got all of the hottest SUVs you've been waiting for. For 2 days only, come in for a test drive and leave with a powerful SUV for just half the price. Yes, you heard it, half the price. Hurry into Valley View as fast as you can, by car or on foot, to take advantage of this outrageous sale. Don't wait, because this promotion is only going on for 48 hours and the SUVs are being driven out of the lot faster than you could say four-wheel drive. Valley View Automotive, SUVs to get you in gear. Four business hopefuls are selected to pitch their ideas to a panel of corporate executives. Only one of them will leave the boardroom with cash in hand to kickstart their company. Billionaire businessman Mark Cuban sits on the panel as a celebrity judge this week and makes a splash in the boardroom that you will not want to miss. All this and more on Jaguar Cable 47. At Sam Adams, we salute those people who did that thing. Build that thing. Tried that thing, messed that thing up, then tried it again. For all those people who believe in going for it, failing, improving, who do their thing the same way we do ours. Because life isn't about whether your glass is half full or half empty, it's about filling it up. Sam Adams, fill your glass.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that. It was fun doing it. And now I've done over 50 auditions, so I should probably redo that because I could do it way better. Anyhow, that's just, you know, a little bit insight into my world. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating and a review on your podcast app. And make sure to visit uberdadshow.com and sign up for our emails. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. All of those are at Uber Dad Show. Thanks so much and see you again next time.